in a Waterloo winter. So I'm going to kick off the conference with a little presentation on aspects of nonlinear perturbation theory in cosmological models. So let's look at this. So basically, I'll be talking about two instances of in which nonlinear perturbations are actually important. First in slow roll inflation, and the second in a period of sitter phase. So you can think of de Sitter as no roll inflation. So the inflaton potential just kind of sits there. Certainly, inflaton field just sits there on a flat potential. So this is based on work in the first part in the long wavelength back reactions, so super Hubble back reactions, with Bill Underwood, I think October of last year. And more recently on the de Sitter case, based on work of April this year and in a paper whose classification I still don't know yet in JFIS-A. So that's sort of how I'm going to do the talk, and I'll conclude afterwards. So why would you want to go beyond second order theory, just heuristically, looking at just the right hand side of any field equations? If you take and look at the Klein-Gordon stress energy, it's at second order in the field. Quadratic the inflaton, if you will. So if you look at the perturbation theory, then as you go from slow roll to de Sitter, you basically go from linear perturbations being the dominant one to purely second order ones being dominant. And so in the background, as you approach de Sitter, so as you, there we go. Can everyone see this dot? Mm-hmm. So as phi bar goes to a pure constant, so a space-time constant, then clearly the background stress energy approaches the vacuum de Sitter solution, and the first order perturbations can't have any non-trivial scalar vector modes because there's a vacuum space-time in the background. So then the second order terms are clearly the leading order terms. And so then the question is generically, kind of hand-wavy, is there some sort of transition to nonlinear dominance in the gravitational field? And so in order to fully answer this, you have to look at the full coupled equations. But this is sort of an indication that you may want to look at that. So that's a heuristic look why you would want to go beyond second order theory. The basic bottom line is that you're compelled to do that just by the structure of the stress energy. So when you look at a little bit deeper, you realize that linear perturbations anyway must consistently seed an entire hierarchy of higher order perturbations. So that means that in order for, say, second order perturbations, which are seeded by linear ones, to be integrable, these linear perturbations are actually constrained in some sense. Okay, so one way to probe this is to look at the initial value constraints, which I've written as script H A is weakly equal to zero. And so these Hamiltonian momentum constraints of the classical theory must be satisfied on each space-time slice, or space-like slice, if you will, that you impose as a foliation of the entire space-time. So order by order, these guys must satisfy initial value constraints. All right, so at second order, the perturbations, must satisfy relations of this form. So you have, just generically, so you have some coefficient A, just a real number, times the linear operator acting on these second order perturbations, which I've schematically labeled delta 2g and delta 2phi. So the second order perturbations in the metric, and some second order perturbations in some matter. In this case, say a scalar field, plus some constant times an operator acting on some quadratic combinations of the linear guys for the linear fluctuations. Okay, so that's just generically what you would get if you expand the second order perturbations on a given slice. So the kicker is that near the de Sitter background, the modulus of this coefficient A is very close to zero, and B is manifestly non-zero. So in order for this relation to have non-trivial solutions, it turns out that at least some components of these second-order fluctuations must get very large. In fact, the concern is that maybe their amplitude, in some sense, will dominate the linear ones. Okay, and this would spell problems, potential problems, for a linear approximation to the problem near de Sitter background. So one interesting feature of this argument is that it's inherently gauge invariant and rather minimal. So what I'm requiring is that a slicing exists, that constraints are satisfied on these slices. That's it. No gauge transformations, none of those headaches. I mean, they are there. We don't need them to find this property.
Okay. So isn't there a subroutine which you, in the splitting, delta g squared?
Is there, sorry?
Well, how do you decide the way you split the metric between first order perturbation and second order perturbation?
Well, it's just a nonsense. So you have a piece that's of order epsilon and a piece that's of order epsilon squared. And you just track orders of epsilon. It's just a perturbative nonsense, and then you get a hierarchy of equations in orders of epsilon. You just put in a nonsense and track epsilon. Not sure if I really understand.
You don't have delta g squared, the second order perturbation being zero, for instance.
You could certainly say that these are zero, but my point is that that's not then the full second order constraint. This is the second order fluctuation in the metric, purely second order. This is the square of the linear perturbation. Okay, so for this reason, I have the gory technical details just in a quick summary of what I actually mean. What I do is I take the initial value constraints, project them along some vector field XA near the sitter background. So then here I've written them as, so they're projections, so they're integrals. So they're integrals over this slice. So you have the constraints acting on these fluctuations projected over this vector field. On the left-hand side, you have the purely second-order fluctuations in the three-metric on the slice and its associated conjugate momenta. And on the right-hand side, the linear combinations of these guys. So it turns out that by an identity, the left-hand side is zero precisely when XA is a killing vector of an exact de Sitter background. So when I'm exactly in de Sitter, this actually turns out to be a constraint on the linear fluctuations, an additional constraint, if you will. However, for some Y near de Sitter, so if we're just slightly, we're an ultra-slow roll, if you will, then some components of this delta 2H and delta 2Pi, so the second-order fluctuations in the three-metric and its momentum, and I've suppressed the matter variables, but they're there as well, must in fact get huge. So that's the technical version of sort of these slides that I just gave you. So this sort of gives you a motivation to look into this, because it is a rather technical problem to go into, and you know, without some motivation, you don't really want to get into it. And this kind of motivated me and Bill to look at this. So I should point out that there's, you know, already a whole bunch of controversy about back reactions in the field. So I think it was in March of last year that Kolb, Notari, and a bunch of other people who unfortunately I've forgotten, wrote a paper on dark energy being mimicked by back reactions of super Hubble modes. And this then ignited a whole bunch of responses from people, including, you know, Wald, Hirata, and Ghazal, I think, a former student of Roberts, Hannah Flanagan, and so on. So there was a whole bunch of controversy about whether or not these back reactions are observable, real, what their effects could be, whether or not they're real or true effect is just a renormalization of the spatial curvature, for example. The hallmark of all of these calculations is that they're really hard. They're poorly controlled approximations. No one really knows how to deal with the UV divergences, how to regularize the sub-horizon stuff. They're inherent at gauge ambiguities, even with the super, in particular with the super Hubble modes. And I think it's fair to say that there's no general consensus on the importance of back reactions, especially during inflation. Okay, so we haven't really probed that or understand that very well. So I just want to emphasize that I focus here only on whether or not linear perturbation theory runs into a specific kind of trouble during slow roll inflation. And at that, only for long wavelengths. So I don't treat the sub-horizon problem at all. So that's where we're sitting in the program of this talk. So what I'm going to do is introduce a specific problem that I'm going to look at. So again, what kind of slow roll background, long wavelengths? I'll show you how I fix the gauges and then try to convince you about the measure of the second order perturbation that I use to compare it to the linear theory and see if it runs into trouble. So the basic setup is just take a flat effort of U slice, slowly rolling metric. It's coupled in photon, expanded to second order in the ansatz, and then get just a hierarchy of equations. The linear equations we all know fairly well. The mathematical picture is that you have a bunch of K modes that are living independently of each other, they don't interact. So K being the Fourier wave vector number, magnitude of it. And at second order, you have, in the red box here, which might as well be Pandora's box, is a second order equation. And so the question then changes. So mode mixing occurs, so different k's interact. So on the right-hand side, you have a whole swath of k-space giving you contributions to a given k at second order. Okay. So in some sense, you generically expect cumulative effects in Fourier space to let the second order modes grow. And that's, in fact, the basic mechanism for some of these back reaction claims, that the infrared phase space during inflation grows to such an extent that these second order modes can overwhelm their natural suppression of being at order epsilon squared to even compare with the linear terms. Okay, and so then the goal here is just to evaluate in some restricted sense how large, compared to the linear perturbations, do the second order perturbations get during slow roll. Okay. So just to give you an idea, the perturbations in detail are, I just perturb the lapse, the shift in the standard way, and then you can see the flat FRW slice and the spatial perturbations, and similarly for the photon. The reason I give this is because then I can refer to these specific terms when I show you later expressions. But the key thing is that I want to emphasize that at linear order, we're all used to throwing away the tensors or the vectors or putting the back end independently of the scalars. At second order, they couple and they mix. So that's sector mixing. So for example, a tensor-tensor combination can seed a scalar mode. It can transform as a scalar, similarly vector-vector. So it's important that when you solve the second order equations, you retain all the sources and retain all the spatial dependencies as well. So the approach in this problem will be to retain all the sectors at linear order and keep only the scalar sector at second order. So for the background, what I do is I pick this admittedly simple potential. So it's a linear n-photon potential, so it's just a constant plus a small tilt. There's an advantage, there's of course a disadvantage to this potential, and that is that if you follow it long enough, your space-time will slowly become, you know, AES, which is not exactly a very realistic model. But on the other hand, if you track it for a small enough region in phi space, it should be an okay first step. Another advantage is that the only non-trivial slow roll condition is, in fact, just the first derivative condition of the e that is identically zero. So, and also that there's a very simple time dependence, background time dependence on the background field, where this is just due to conservation of stress energy. So that's the ansatz for the background slow roll space-time. And as I said, what I'm only going to be looking at is scales of long wavelength k, by which I mean that modes from the Hubble radius here all the way up to some infrared cutoff, which I'll call k-min. So the crosshatched region here is the swath of k-modes which will contribute to a given second-order mode. Okay, so those are the ones that are going to appear in the second-order source on the right-hand side. And in fact, form the bounds in this integral right here. So this infrared cutoff acts as the scale at which I'm going to cut off the various infrared divergences that occur, and here are the homogeneous modes right here. This intermediate k tilde, unfortunately, remained from some other consideration that I had, so you can sort of try and ignore it. But I'd like to emphasize once again that the sub-horizon modes are not treated here. So just let me underscore this once more. So you have this happy little girl in linear land who's opened this treat. I guess it's a Christmas gift now. I guess that'd be appropriate to say. But out of this pops out this whole panoply of stuff, which the true second-order problem holds. I emphasize this because there are a number of approaches in the literature which use an effective method. An effective method which takes the Einstein equations, solves them or expands them to second order, assumes the linear equations hold, and then does a spatial averaging, which is highly hypersurface dependent. Then the linear terms automatically drop out, and you're left with an effective stress energy that then seeds a new homogeneous mode. This, in and of itself, is not the second-order mode approach that I'm talking about, and can be shown to have some consistency problems. And in that way, it's advantageous because it avoids these issues, but I believe that you must confront them. One of the hallmarks of this is that if you solve, say, the constraint equations at second order, you can get terms that are something like a hierarchy of small parameters. So you can have a long wavelength term divided by a simple roll parameter. Those at large or small. So you're faced with that kind of issue. And secondly, the second order gauge sector actually has to depend on the linear one. And so you have to be very careful how you fix them. So these two crucial issues sort of distinguish the boring old second order approach, which I'm advocating, with these effective methods. And similarly, the UV regularization, no one knows how to do it. So you have these second order Einstein equations. What do you do with them? Our goal was to have some measure of it in terms of an effective equation state at second order in perturbation theory. So what we wanted to do was construct some measure of the energy density. So you have the background, the first order, and then the cumulative contribution at second order, and similarly for the average pressure. And then to take these expressions and evaluate their dispersions, respectively at linear and at second order. And once you have that, you can demand a notion of linearized consistency, which is that, namely, that the linearized dispersion, okay, evaluated in some standard vacuum at a given spatial scale, so say, for example, at the Hubble scale, be larger than the corresponding second order perturbation dispersion. Okay? So this better hold for your linear perturbation theory to be consistent, so that you're dropping terms that are of marginal significance and retaining ones that are of important significance. So that's the main goal. That's sort of the main formulation that we're trying to get a simple expression for how slow you can get to De Sitter, how close you can get to De Sitter without this actually failing.
You've chosen a potential which at linear order would give you a red spectrum with perturbation.
Okay.
Is epsilon is positive?
Yes, epsilon is positive. Yeah.
And eta is zero.
Eta is zero, yeah. It's really simple.
So in some sense you are choosing a potential which will make things sensitive to infrared.
Yes.
If it's correct.
Yes. Yeah. But later on I'll show how you can. It's kind of hard to have that intuition, I agree. It's sensitive then more to red, but if you look at the chaotic, you'll also get similar results. So M squared phi squared. If you look at M squared phi squared.
That would probably also I was also thinking, like, maybe if you choose some other types of potential, like, would you be blue red or results? Or
I guess I can't think offhand which one would be blue, but we can discuss it. just to belabor the point a little bit more, because everyone always asks this, so how on earth do I set the first and second order gauges? Just a brief moment on that. What we do is emulate the harmonic gauge, which is useful in many contexts. The generalization for the entire linear sector is so setting the scalar vector at tensor modes, because the tensor modes are now gauge variant at second order. They're not gauge invariant anymore. Is to employ this Poisson gauge, which is basically a generalization of the longitudinal gauge of the scalar sector that we all know about. Except this time you're actually setting the perturbation to zero instead of its potential. So basically that's how we set the linear sector. And at the second order, what I do is set a effective analog of the longitudinal gauge. So the off-diagonal, the shift perturbation at second order is zero, and the diagonal, off-diagonal rather, spatial perturbations are zero. However, by the equations of motion, I just write this up just for your information, that the scalar lapse perturbation at second order is not only a function of other scalar perturbations, so for example, the diagonal spatial perturbation at second order, but also of the graviton-graviton sector and the scalar-scalar. So they enter. So if you're looking at sort of the proper time measured by an observer from hypersurface to hypersurface to the second order, it will depend on the linear graviton waves and the scalar-scalar interactions at linear order in this way. So that's interesting. That's a further example of how to use the equations of motion to find the sector mixing. Once we have all of this, we ask, well, how do we find these eigenvalues, these energy densities and pressures? One way is to just simply ask, what are the eigenvalues of the total stress energy at second order? And to define, for example, the energy density rho is minus the time-like eigenvalue. And similarly for the average pressures. This has distinct advantages because to find the eigenvalues of the stress energy of mixed valence, so up index, down index, has special gauge covariance properties. So that has a distinct advantage. Alternatively, you can think of this as expressing your purported energy densities of pressures in terms of genuine scalars, like traces of the stress energy and products of their trace-free parts, and so on and so forth. So, for example, you can perturb the second order trace and get relationships for the energy densities and the pressures. And similarly, you can find expressions for the off-diagonal shears that are going to, in general, occur for the second order pressures and try to substitute them out, because in the end, what you want is just an isotropic contribution, because that's what you really want to measure. So the bottom line is that we take these second order equations and try to find some measure of the energy density and pressure, and we use this eigenvalue method to find them. So once you have this, you have a giant mess of perturbations on the right-hand side of the equation, so the definitions of these quantities. And so again, how do we reduce the mess? We do the gauge fixing. We then solve the constraint equations. So not only the first order ones, but the second order ones. You solve the constraint equations, and then you're given these constrained evolution equations. And we solve them then for exclusively just the linear. So we solve the second order perturbations in terms of the linear ones. So then at the end of the day, we're left with these giant expressions for delta 2 rho and delta 2 pi here, the second order energy densities and the pressures, exclusively in terms of these perturbations, these diagonal perturbations psi. So then it's then a relatively straightforward matter to calculate the dispersion of these quantities of delta 2 rho and delta 2 pi. Using familiar expressions like k cubed mod psi squared is equal to some constant which goes over 1 over epsilon slow roll. So this is fairly standard stuff. Just as an intermediate step, you know that the two-point function of the psi as expanded in the normal annihilation and creation operators has to have homogeneous support because of the Poincaré invariance of these linearized fluctuations. However, what we want to do is find the fluctuations in this operator psi squared. Okay, so then we use Wick's theorem and find these expressions right here. And then this basically gives us, after slogging through it quite a bit, a way to calculate this delta 2p, for example, squared, this second order pressure squared. So that, for example, here gives you three dominant terms. A term that you would find using any one of these effective methods that I was talking about earlier, plus two terms that arise purely from the second order theory. So the second order equations of motion enter exactly. These terms would be zero. So you can see that this LQ here and this LQ, this is an operator acting on a specific combination of terms of second order, appears and also appears in terms of a cross term. When you slog through this and basically do these integrals, which are integrals over k space, you figure out that all of these expressions basically have this leading order dependence on the slow roll parameter. And then the only question is, none of this is controversial, the only question is, what is the value of these numbers? So you can see already that there's a cumulative contribution in the sense that there's a dependence on the number of e-foldings, n, and this is furthermore enhanced by a 1 over slow roll factor. And similarly, these other unique numbers, b1 and c1, are prefixes or coefficients of logarithms, which might as well have magnitude 1. All logarithms have magnitude 1 in these problems, more or less. So then, finally, so we have this consistency requirement, and we ask, well, what is the requirement of the background such that this be true? We now have the expressions necessary to actually evaluate this. And what surprised us is that when you look at it, so you basically get this sort of inequality. This A1 is a coefficient, n is the number of e-foldings. It's a weak dependence in the sense that n is going to the 1/4 power. But if you put in 70 or 60 or whatever your favorite number is for the number of e-foldings required, and kappa here is like 1 over n Planck squared, and you put in these numbers, then it turns out that this is about 3 or 4. So what this means is that in order for the linear perturbation theory to be dominant, epsilon slow roll must be larger than 1. Or conversely, if you're in slow roll, the second order perturbations are inherently dominating. So that's worrisome. Of course, we know that it could be a gauge effect, it could be an effect of a special choice of potential, it could be a number of other things. But it's a worrisome aspect. It's basically saying that at slow roll in the background, these infrared perturbations are getting very, very large in amplitude at these numbers of defoldings. Okay. So for a lower number of defoldings, you won't have this. But of course, we all know that we need 60 or 70 to solve various problems, horizon, et cetera, et cetera. So, okay, so that's just a worrisome indication. It's certainly not conclusive. One thing to do to investigate this is to say, okay, well, let's keep better track of the gauge types. I mean, we've exhaustively fixed the gauge fixing before, but let's see if we can do better. So one idea was to look at perturbations in this quantity I call theta, which is the product of these trace-free parts, the stress energy. And that means then shifting the focus from an energy density or pressure to just some combination of that, which has a, I mean, energy densities and pressures are not really scalars. So it's not really meaningful, too meaningful to be isolating one or the other. So the advantage of looking at theta is that it's almost gauge invariant. So that means that the closer you are to the sitter, the more gauge invariant it is. Okay, because rho plus p background squared has a time derivative that better be very weak. And when you go through the entire calculation again, you find that the dispersion of theta at second order still dominates that of the linear dispersion even for slow roll. Okay, so that's interesting. Then you can ask, well, okay, is this a, was that previous inequality a function just of the choice of the inflaton potential? And so if you redo the calculations of V, redo the calculations with a different potential, namely the chaotic inflation potential, so just a simple m squared phi squared potential, and then you compute some, since I don't have time right now, some measure, another measure, which even has better gauge transformation properties, and compare it to delta theta over theta bar squared. So this dispersion of this, I would argue, observable quantity versus this one, you still obtain that epsilon slow roll is larger than 1 for linear dominance, or conversely, that during slow roll, these second order terms dominate. So it's a worrisome indication. I think a lot more needs to be probed. That's sort of our worry. Our worry is that during slow roll background, these higher order perturbations could get significant.
Maybe I'm missing something, but you had some growth because you had some divergences and came in going to zero, basically.
Yeah, I got an infrared cutoff. Yeah.
That you near infrared cutoff.
Right, right. So then it's a valid concern. So if I'm comparing, in some sense, the renormalization to a homogeneous mode, then it's unfair, in some sense, I think, what you're saying, to compare the second order modes there with the linear order modes, which are already diverging anyway, because k cubed psi squared, as k goes to 0 log psi squared goes to. So that's why I compare them actually in a region that's less homogeneous than the higher R cutoff. So I actually do the fair comparison. You see what I'm saying? So this is. So I actually do the comparison of the amplitudes at this k tilde scale, well away from any divergences. So that's where I compare the amplitudes. We can discuss this in greater detail,
But there is, I guess the simple point I wanted to make is that there is a natural IR cutoff in any inflationary model, which is the scale.
Which the modes are born, right? Basically.
No, actually, sorry. I was going to say, if I look at large, smaller k, I'm looking at modes that exited the horizon earlier on, obviously in the past. And clearly, in that limit in your potential, in the past, the solution was closer and closer to the sitter.
Yes.
And so the cutoff I would put is the onset of eternal inflation.
Okay.
Which would occur at some initial time. So I
so you're wondering, is this cutoff dependent, the result, or is it?
Well, that's one thing, but also even if it is cutoff dependent, there would be a natural cutoff in an inflationary model, which would be.
Okay, so you're reacting to the arbitrariness or the apparent arbitrariness of this that as I've written it, or
no,
is it?
No, I mean, it's a minor point. I'm just saying that if you look back in time, your inflation cannot have lasted in your classical story,
sure, I agree with that.
Eternal inflation. So you would have some came in which would not be that small.
You mean compared to the Hubble
scale?
Okay.
I mean, it's not, I think, it's not, well.
Well, in any case, I don't think it very strongly depends on Kn. This is just how long inflation lasts, really.
Okay.
That's the real. Okay, so we've covered the sort of slow roll case. Now let's even retreat that, because it's already a mess in slow roll. Let's go to no roll. That simplifies it even more. However, there's a surprise there, too. So in no roll, which is the sitter, you have a much simpler arena to basically play with, because the linear sector, the linear matter, or the linear perturbative sector is very simple. There is no Dardo scalar or vector mode. It's only transverse traceless tensor modes, gravity waves. So we're just going to couple a linear scalar field to gravity, the leading order. And I'm going to discuss this notion of a linearization of stability, quantum anomalies associated with that, and then maybe you get into an unexpected mini problem of time. So in the sitter space, I'm just going to quickly go through the difference between the previous formulation and this one. What I'm going to do is do a little even more simple ansatz. What I'm going to do is ignore the linear gravitational perturbations. Or rather, call the linear gravitational perturbations these terms at epsilon squared. So I'm going to ignore the transverse traceless perturbations that occur. And in the background, I'm just going to take an R cross S3 slice. By that, this is just fancy talk for take the sitter and use a closed coordinate chart on it. The advantage is that there's only one coordinate chart necessary to cover the entire spacetime, and similarly perturb the scalar field. So you get Einstein equations, which are higher order, because as I mentioned, the stress energy occurs to leading order and second order. You can express, indeed, the second order stress energy in terms of these monomials, delta phi squared and delta phi background covariant derivative A and B on delta phi. And that's if you assume the Leibniz rule. So remember, these are distributional derivatives, and these are quantum distributions. So it gets a little messier. Anyways, you could write down the stress energy as such. And the leading order equations are then of the form linearized gravity, or the gravity ignoring the transverse traceless waves, is sourced by some nonlinear matter source. So the generic complications of, you know, of interacting quantum fields and curved spacetime are that any nonlinear polynomial of them is fundamentally meaningless without some regularization or renormalization. There is a renormalization ambiguity associated with that. In fact, until recently, interacting fields in curved spacetime had a renormalization ambiguity which was expressed in terms of coupling functions at order by order instead of coupling constants. Sorry, not renormalization constants, not functions. And what Hollins and Wald recently showed, I think about 2-3 years ago, was that you can reduce, in fact, I think Stephen Seven Hollins came and gave a talk here, I'm not sure. He said that basically they proved that this ambiguity can be reduced to a finite number of parameters in curved spacetime, namely to those of Minkowski plus those associated with the couplings of the field to the curvature, using two simple requirements, locality and covariance. Basically, they're axiomatic approach. The bottom line, though, is that these very technical papers, for the first time, have allowed us to, in a rigorous manner, treat interacting fields in curved spacetime for arbitrary interaction Lagrangians. OK, so what we do is then use their work to justify some of our steps. So when you write down the Einstein equations, and then you ask, well, how are the Bianchi identities satisfied order by order? So you take the Bianchi identities around the sitter background, vary this. The variation of the lambda term drops up, because it's all a constant. You basically then have an option to vary the Bianchi identity times the Killing vector of the sitter background. When you do this, you find that the right-hand side of this variation right here drops out if there's a Killing vector. So then you can integrate this on both sides, use Gauss's theorem, and get a constraint on these fluctuations. So this is then the left-hand side of the Einstein equations to this order. And this integral is independent of the hypersurface and the variation of the metric. Basically, what you end up with is an integral constraint on these scalar field fluctuations, which occurs at second order. Okay, so this is then a linearization stability condition. So what this means then is that you've got a theory And you've got these fluctuations, but you're not sure if these are genuine linearizations, the solutions of this, these field equations, genuine linearizations of a full, the full solution around that point in solution space. So that's what you have to be careful about. There's actually a necessary condition that they have to satisfy in order for them to satisfy this property. And so what are the consequences of this nonlinear constraint? This constraint which may well have anomalies because it's nonlinear. So anomalies are that these classical equations of motion that they satisfy and these additional nonlinear conditions may not simultaneously hold. The classic example, for example, is the 2D trace anomaly. So what Collins and Wall did was they proved that these monomials, these nonlinear monomials, actually satisfy uniqueness theorems, that they can in fact be modified by these renormalization terms, which go as curvature scalars of appropriate dimension. So when you actually go through the math and do this, you can check and see that the anomalies go as terms which are automatically zero. So they go as integrals of these normal components of Killing vectors. Okay, so it turns out to be a very simple identity and rather simple to prove that these conditions have no anomalies. So fine, all of this is formalism and who really cares about all of this? And so then in the end, what really brought up our attention was that these conditions actually form a Lie algebra, which is the same, has the same structure constants as that of the Killing vectors in the background. So what that really means is that these linearization stability conditions that you place on the field demand full de-Sitter invariance of the states. So let me just back up and tell you what all this means. You've taken a linear scalar field in de-Sitter spacetime, which has a rich set of possible states, including ones that aren't invariant or have any other special properties, and demanded that you consistently couple this to gravity. That demand turns out to be equivalent to saying that all the states, entire tower of states, not only the vacuum, but the entire tower of states, has to be de-Sitter invariant. Okay? Now contrast this with the flat spacetime statement, which is that only the vacuum is point-to-rate invariant. Okay? So that's rather surprising and problematic, especially if you have a massless scalar field, which has no de-Sitter invariant vacuum, which Allen showed some years ago, simply because it has this zero mode in the action. And furthermore, even if you have de-Sitter invariant states, how do you do dynamics with them? How do you describe any localization with de-Sitter invariant states? This is very similar to, in fact, the problem of time and full general relativity, which instead of de-Sitter invariance has full diffeomorphism invariance at its heart. So de-Sitter invariance is, in fact, rather tractable because it's a bulk invariance. It's just these large boosts and rotations. Okay, so there are 10 vectors, 4 boosts and 6 rotations. And furthermore, if you look at it, so as lambda goes to 0, how do you, in fact, describe the limit? Is it a uniform limit? So again, in the flat space time, you only have an invariant vacuum, Poincaré invariant vacuum. So how do you go from a situation where you have a tower of states that's de-Sitter invariant to a situation where the excited states can be anything and only the vacuum is Poincaré invariant? So those are some interesting, it's just interesting that we started with something that was seemed like it was involved only with cosmology and then ended up with something that looked like it was out of Wheeler's program in the 70s or the 80s when they were looking at geometrodynamics and so on. So one of the key loopholes in this analysis was in fact that I ignored in this original onslaught the gravitational waves, so that in this constraint you would actually have terms that went as delta G squared. So maybe these guys have anomalies that would mess this conclusion up. Turns out they don't. The basic technical reason is that you can, using the result due to Parker and Ford in the 70s, you can show that these perturbations, these gravitational wave perturbations, can be treated as an additional 2 scalar fields mod some technical conditions. So then the results go through just with this sort of simple substitution in the results. So the result was surprisingly robust. And so then one is confronted with the question, what do you do with these de-Sitter invariant states? So I think I don't know when I started. Okay. So I have time still or
yeah, sure.
Okay. Okay. Did I got it? Okay. Yeah. So then again, what do, there could be this actual limit. So as so, if you take Newton's g, which is non-zero, small, in some sense, then you have these constraints. So you have a coupling to gravity. If you take g to zero, then you have no coupling to gravity and no constraints. So you can imagine taking limits of g going to zero and lambda going to zero. So there are no SO4-1 constraints, and asking what kind of limit that is. Okay, is it a uniform limit? Is it not? And what we're trying to do now is try to keep. Well, it looks like that tech didn't work there. I'm sure everyone can read that though by now. Like that's how I visualize these things. but anyway, so you can take the ratio of the parameters and try to keep them constant. Maybe that will give you some insight. But in any case, it doesn't seem like it's very straightforward. The basic bottom line though is that, you know, for the infinite order theory, you're not really going to expect this invariance property to survive. This is an artifact of perturbation theory of this order. However, it could just be that perturbation theory is just giving us garbage of this order. So here are the basic conclusions. During second order, so if you look at slow roll inflation and examine only the IR sector of the second order fluctuations, there are strong indications, or suggested indications, that these perturbations or the amplitude of the second order perturbations can get really quite large. And in fact, dominate that of the linear theory and perhaps put linear perturbation theory in some sort of hot water. Similarly, the quantum field theory of a scalar field in De Sitter, when it's coupled to leading and it turns out subleading order to gravity, has a mutilated space of states, which is surprising and rather problematic. So future directions could include looking at these UV effects, because now, as I mentioned, we have these tools due to Holland and Wald how to actually treat these interacting fields in curved spacetime, and maybe even treat these constraints seriously, these De Sitter invariant states, or constraints that lead to these states, and try to construct non-trivial De Sitter invariant states, and perhaps make progress in an investigation of some simplified version of the problem of time, GR. So it's interesting that you start with one avenue, and then you see how interconnected all of this is, going from cosmology to problems in GR. So thanks for your attention.
Yeah. So in the last slide, you're talking about this G and lambda go to zero limit, but is there an order of limits issue here?
Yeah.
Because taking G to zero and taking lambda to zero, I could imagine having much different effects.
Oh yeah.
If I take one or the other.
Yeah.
So have you thought about that, or like?
Well, no. I mean, not beyond knowing that, no. I mean, I'm aware of how different those two limits are.
Okay.
But I mean, that's part of the reason for trying to take some combination or fractions of these guys to zero, trying to keep them decent in some sense. I mean, the main limit that bothers me, to be honest with you, is lambda going to zero, not G.
You change the boundary conditions, right?
Yeah.
It's very, the effective theory of this scalar field is going to be very different.
Yes.
It's asymptotically flat.
Right. But the main thing is just even understanding that lambda is very small. You suddenly have this huge constraint, a global constraint, with lambda being very tiny. It's very hard to understand how, for example, a local observer would care about lambda being very tiny. I mean, you would think that it shouldn't really matter, that you still should be able to construct consider non-invariant states. It shouldn't matter. That's not what Formal was saying.
Yeah. I don't know, quick question. So I think this is work by Scott Watson, Henry Tai, and some other people, and they talk about spontaneously breaking SO4-1 symmetry with perturbations. I was wondering if you were familiar with that.
I'm not familiar with that, no. What kind of, I mean, this sort of constraint is actually most apparent when you use this. It's not slicing dependent, but it's most evident in this flow slicing. And sometimes, like for example, people like Richard Woodard wouldn't see these effects in flat slicing because they don't have these. The formalism is harder to see, so the constraint, the zero, involves an integral over a closed slice, which is zero. So I don't know. Some people who use the flat slicing, in other words, don't find these constraints. So it could be that. Yeah.
So when you're finding problems with the inflationary perturbation stuff, Is it just the, are you saying that there might just be a bad choice of small parameter than that you're expanding? I mean,
no, what I'm saying is that the if you take just the standard lore, so right. The standard pictures, make the standard assumptions, and it would even appear the standard potentials, if you go through the exercise and look genuinely at second order and perturbation theory and just make this comparison in amplitudes, they seem to be getting large. So it isn't,
right.
I mean, are you saying what choice of slow roll parameter or?
Yeah,
or
I mean, could you fix this? I mean, is there no, is it just an intrinsic, like, bad system where it has all these crazy infrared effects, or are you somehow making the, or by choosing slow roll, are you making the problem, are you making the problem?
If we are doing that, we're not aware of it. We're trying to see if it's the first case that you mentioned, which is that, is the system intrinsically sick? I can't see how offhand, I mean, I could be making it sick. I mean, it could be that I'm choosing some variables that go.
I mean, like, we're, like, the whole, everyone who's, like, slow roll, I mean, maybe yeah. Is slow roll itself sort of the problem?
That's the concern. In fact, this isn't really even my original concern. This was brought up by Grisham. In 98, there was a big debate about whether or not scalar modes are enhanced by the one over phi dot factor compared to tensor modes. And he brought this issue up, and it has since been debated, and some people have in fact concluded that it's just the slow roll approximation, which is going nuts. So that's precisely what we're trying to see here. It looks sick.
Right, yeah, I'm not sure. I can't evaluate all that fancy math, but I just was wondering, I mean, you can somehow find, I mean, whether is it just in these tactics, basically expanding exponentially, sort of, is that?
Well, it's not really expanding exponentially, it's just, say, it's like a t to the alpha, where alpha is huge.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm just trying to get, like, are there, this approach would expose problems in perturbation theory in other contexts, is what I guess what I'm trying to say.
It may well. I don't know. I don't know what. I mean, what's actually happening here is that you have three non-independent, but still three parameters that are going small. You have k going to zero, you have epsilon going to zero, and you have, in some sense, the strength of the metric and matter perturbations, but all of these are somehow tied together. So,
there's only epsilon going. It's only epsilon going to zero your problem, right? Because
epsilon is slow roll.
It's
right?
tied to k going to zero.
Right. But the main thing is that you get this problem precisely because you do not ignore. So if you drop all gradients in your equations of motion, and then start going ahead and solving the constraints, you will not get this problem. Mm-hmm. But the problem is if you retain the gradients and then start dividing through by slow rolls, these guys stick in the equations of motion and cause you problems later on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's part of what I disagree with in some of the ways that people do it, is that they drop the gradients in the beginning. I think you can easily drop them at the end and just keep them and see what happens. And I think that may be part of the problem.
Can I follow up on Mark's point? Because I think it's important. So, what's the resolution with just the standard action nodes? But it's just the standard phi dot goes to zero or limit of h squared over phi dot? Because in the sitter, just linear things, you don't expect these big fluctuations.
You don't expect. So. What is the resolution of?
Just naively, zeta is h squared over phi dot. Phi dot goes to zero and then it's up here to sitter.
Right.
So it suggests that. First of all, there's. Yeah, I mean, one of the things I would think is also, I don't remember what you calculated, but I could imagine that you calculated a variable which happens to be sick in the limit of the sitter.
Okay, so that's part of. Okay, so one worry would be, for example, setting a. Constant phi gauge. I think
right.
That's what you're saying.
Because right.
That goes as 1 over phi dot.
Right.
We do not set that gauge. So that we let phi fluctuate all at once. We just set these other guys, which are actually well-defined in the sitter limit. So we are careful about that. So it's not in the gauge choice. It's not in the variables. We make the appropriate cutoff, I think, in k. So we know we're not getting it from k. We're careful in which we choose to divert this to phi dot. So it's not obvious to us how it's happening. I mean, it could well be something involved, but not on the first. You said something that I wanted to comment on, but I forgot. What was the first part of your comment? I forgot.
The first part was just to remind myself of divergence.
Oh, okay.
I just meant linear order.
Well, just
there's
one thing.
There.
Yeah. One thing that people often get confused about is that at pure de Sitter, there are no scalar modes. So if you have a divergent scalar mode, who cares? Right? There are no non-gauge scalar modes at the sitter. So it's a tricky thing. You are getting a divergence, but at that limit, there are no scalar. There's no scalar modes or vector modes.
So doesn't that tell you that it should be pure gauge or different?
But we don't know. See, that's the thing. We don't know what kind of limit it is. We don't know what if it's a uniform limit or you know, we're only asking. We're never really getting to de Sitter in this case. We don't want de Sitter. We want Sloral. So we're saying how close to de Sitter can we keep Sloral?
But your divergence, sorry, but okay. Your divergence is a divergence related to going to de Sitter limit.
It is related to it, okay. But it's also related to this k going to zero.
Well, I would say for your choice of potential, that's the same problem because
the dominant
k going to zero is like taking epsilon to zero.
Sure. So I agree with you. The dominant effect is the phi dot going to zero, but we never go to zero. We just stay in this full roll business. So, and if you pick variables that behave well as phi dot goes to zero, so you know in the back of your mind that these scalar radiations are zero anyway. Then it's fine to probe the problem. And it's just a formal question. You have these orders of perturbation theory. The second order better be smaller than the first.
Well, so can you make a theory that has a second order smaller than the first that also preserves an inflationary prediction?
I don't know if I can right now. But
I mean, knowing all the things that go wrong, can you have any inkling of an idea of a way to get other kind of theory that could do that? I mean, or is it just complicated feedback?
Well, I guess you could, because then you could sort of pick, but you wouldn't get the Einstein equations. That would certainly be the case. You'd have to modify the constraints of second order. And you could do it, but I don't know what kind of theory that would be. I don't know what kind of gravity.
Well, in your case, I think, maybe I'm wrong, but I think if you picked an inflationary model, that's what I was kind of alluding to at the beginning,
okay.
As a blue spectrum, that means that earlier on you were further and further from the sitter. Whereas in your case, in the past, you're closer and closer to the sitter. So I would expect if you had a blue spectrum, then you wouldn't have these. Because phi dot was greater in the past than such a model.
But see, okay, but it's an integrated effect, though. It's not really, okay, so as long as I have the same number of e-foldings in this blue or the red one, I should have still these. Because in both cases, the infrared phase space is growing quite a bit. I mean, the Hubble radius is shrinking. More and more modes are exiting as you inflate. Mm-hmm. And these integrals are cumulative, guys. So they're going to get bigger and bigger in both scenarios. They're just reversing the order in which they get bigger. But I see your point. You know, it'd be interesting to investigate. Thanks again.
Yeah.